Welcome to Science Matters. My name is Cynthia Ehlich, and I'm your host today on Sun Sounds of Arizona. And today is Sunday, June 8th, 2025. First, ocean plant cell discovery might revolutionize farming, by Ari Daniel. From NPR, broadcast on March 13th, 2025. A new part of an ocean plant cell has been discovered that might revolutionize farming one day. The structure can take nitrogen and convert it into the ingredient that helps all organisms grow. The host, A. Martinez. We are going to zoom in on this next story, actually zoom way in. A team of scientists looking at a microscopic mystery recently won a top prize from the publisher of the journal Science. Reporter Ari Daniel has more on their discovery and how it might revolutionize farming. Ari Daniel, byline. John Zaire, a now retired microbial ecologist from UC Santa Cruz, was confronted with the puzzle. On research cruises while testing seawater, he and his colleagues kept finding the same fragment of DNA in the ocean. But when they went to look for the organism it came from, no one ever managed to see it. John Zaire. Every time we would get these samples, we looked through the microscope and there's nothing there. Daniel. And yet, the DNA was everywhere, in the open ocean, along the coast, in the tropics, the Arctic. It also appeared to have a special and rare function of taking nitrogen from the surroundings, which living things need to survive, and turning it into a form that could then be fashioned into proteins and DNA. Usable nitrogen like this is pretty scarce. Zaire. That's why we add it as fertilizer in agriculture. Same is true in the oceans. It's in short supply over wide regions of the ocean. Ari Daniel. Up until now, the ability to transform nitrogen was a feat scientists thought only certain kinds of bacteria and other simple microbes could pull off. But here's what this puzzle wound up revealing. Some 140 million years ago, a free-living bacteria that could grab all the nitrogen it wanted out of the water it was swimming in fused with an ancient algal cell, says Tyler Cole, a biologist with UC Santa Cruz. Tyler Cole, one cell engulfs another and then doesn't digest it, but rather incorporates it into its own body. Over time, the bacteria jettisoned some of its genes, says Ari Daniel. The algae became dependent on the nitrogen it was receiving until eventually each one could no longer live without the other. Cole, so the process of two species becoming one. Daniel, this is a lot like what gave rise to the mitochondria and chloroplast, but in this case, it led to a cellular structure that could transform nitrogen into something useful. The researchers called it the nitroplast, and it's responsible for pumping significant amounts of nitrogen into the global ocean. Solving this microscopic riddle took years. The first clue was that whatever had produced this fragment of DNA was missing all sorts of genes. To survive, Zaire figured it had to be getting help from another life form. He says, because it lives with somebody else who can provide those things. Daniel, he was right. That somebody else turned out to be a kind of single-celled algae that looks like a teensy soccer ball. The team partnered with the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory to use X-rays to peer inside that soccer ball. Structural biologist Valentina Loconte was struck by what she saw. Inside the alga, I found the little cell, she says. Daniel, this little entity, what appeared at the time to be a little cell, was the oddball source of all that DNA in the ocean. Loconte, it means that the two organisms are really living together. Daniel, Tyler Cole pored over the inner workings of both. He found the little guy's missing genes were housed in the big cell, and the big cell received nitrogen from the little guy. That is, the two needed one another. Cole, And at that point, it makes it very difficult to call these two different organisms if their genomes are so intermingled. Daniel, instead, this was a single organism. The little guy was actually the nitroplast, a component of the bigger algal cell. This nitroplast allowed the more complex organism, so not a simple microbe, it had a nucleus, to capture its own nitrogen. Doug Capone. It's been in plain sight, but to get the details that finally made the leap of faith, wow, that's really cool. Daniel. Doug Capone is a biological oceanographer at the University of Southern California who wasn't involved with the discovery. He says the nitroplast could be introduced someday to crops to allow them to convert their own nitrogen without relying on external fertilizer. Capone. This provides a model system for how one might integrate the nitroplast into an agriculturally important crop. It's one of the holy grails of biotechnology, says John Zare, the ability to engineer plants that could snatch nitrogen out of the air and use it to grow without any of the pollution, energy, or expense that current fertilizers require. For NPR News, I'm Ari Daniel. And that was heard on Morning Edition, NPR's broadcast on March 13, 2025. Ocean plant cell discovery might revolutionize farming. And just 4 days after this report was filed, an exciting event. NASA astronauts' 9-month orbital odyssey ends in a splashdown. Sonny Williams and Butch Wilmore finally made it home to Earth after a 17-hour trip aboard a SpaceX capsule. Reported by Kenneth Chang and Thomas Fuller, published March 17th and updated March 18th, 2025. They set off to spend 8 days at the space station. The trip lasted 9 months. On Tuesday, two NASA astronauts who had been in orbit since June, Sonny Williams and Butch Wilmore, splashed down in calm azure waters off the coast of the Florida Panhandle, concluding a saga that had captivated the country since last summer. Ms. Williams and Mr. Wilmore blasted off in June 2024 for the International Space Station on their test flight of Starliner, a Boeing spacecraft that was to provide NASA with another option outside of SpaceX to carry astronauts to and from orbit. But the Starliner experienced problems with its propulsion system, prompting NASA to send it back to Earth with no crew aboard. It was a SpaceX capsule, the Crew Dragon, that brought them back from space on Tuesday. The spacecraft detached from the space station just after 1 a.m. Eastern Time and then traveled back to Earth, slowing down for more than 17,000 miles an hour before deploying 4 large parachutes that gently plopped the spacecraft into the water just before 6 p.m. Minutes later, as recovery teams inspected the capsule, a pod of curious dolphins circled, a playful terrestrial welcoming party. Once the capsule had been hoisted onto a ship, the door was opened and the beaming astronauts were extracted from the spacecraft. After months of weightlessness, their bodies still adjusting to the pull of gravity, they were lifted onto gurneys. They all looked very healthy, Steve Stitch, the manager of NASA's commercial crew program, said during a news conference after the splashdown. They all looked like they were feeling about normal for the landing and recovery phase, where their body is trying to readapt. Returning with the two astronauts were Nick Hague, the commander of this mission known as Crew 9, and Alexandra Gorbunov, a Russian astronaut. The four astronauts were scheduled to fly back to NASA's Johnson Space Center in Houston, where they were to remain briefly until doctors let them go home. They'll rejoin their families in the next day or so, Mr. Stitch said. The mission both underlined the dominance of SpaceX in the growing field of private spacecraft and the comparative woes of Boeing. But as with so many things in the early stages of the current administration, the astronauts' return was tinged with politics. The president suggested in January that the Biden administration had stranded the astronauts. And Elon Musk, who is the founder of SpaceX, said this month that the Biden administration had rejected his offer to bring them home sooner. But Bill Nelson, who served as the administrator of NASA during the Biden administration, said that NASA never heard about Mr. Musk's offer and that the agency's decisions were based on what made the most sense for the operations of the space station. On the basis that there was no contact with NASA, there was no political consideration from NASA's point of view, Mr. Nelson said. About a half hour after the astronauts returned, the White House posted on social media, "Promise made, promise kept." The president pledged to rescue the astronauts stranded in space for 9 months. However, it has been NASA's plan since August for the Crew 9 mission to return with Ms. Williams and Mr. Wilmore around this time frame. An hour after the White House post, Mr. Musk offered celebratory congratulations on X to teams at SpaceX and NASA for another safe astronaut return. But the astronauts also disputed the notion that they were stuck in space. "It's work, it's fun, it's been trying at times, no doubt," Mr. Wilmore said in an interview from the space station last week with the New York Times. "But stranded? No. Stuck? No. Abandoned? No." At the station, Ms. Williams and Mr. Wilmore had to adjust to their unexpectedly long stay. From the start, they were short of clothes because their suitcases had been left off the Starliner to make room for a replacement pump to fix the toilet. They relied on spare clothing in the space station. NASA sent up their clothes and other personal items a couple of months later on a Northrop Grumman cargo ship. Such robotic cargo ships arrive periodically from Russia and the United States, bringing food, supplies, and experiments. According to a summary published by NASA, astronauts at the space station, which orbits about 250 miles above the Earth, carried out a variety of tasks on the station, including maintenance work and nearly 1,000 hours of scientific research. That included a spacewalk by Ms. Williams and Mr. Wilmore to swab the outside of the space station to see if Earth microbes could survive and maybe even thrive in space. Ms. Williams also helped set up an experiment to study how microbes produced nutrients like vitamins, and also conducted research on how weightlessness affected microscopic organisms that could be used to make food and medicines, NASA said. The astronauts were able to connect with friends, family, and the public on the ground. They had access to email and video calls. They tried to put a positive spin on the whole experience. "You get a little bit more time to enjoy the view out the window," Ms. Williams said in the interview with the Times last week. Not everything they saw was pleasing. From space, Mr. Wilmore saw Hurricane Beryl, which hit Houston last July. The storm damaged the roof of his home. The astronauts also saw the smoke from the Los Angeles fires in January. Mr. Wilmore, who has a wife and two children, missed most of his younger daughter's senior year of high school and his elder daughter's sophomore year in college. He said his younger daughter was tough, but she also told him, "I didn't know how much I needed you until you were gone." And this report, NASA Astronauts' 9-Month Orbital Odyssey, ends in a splashdown, was posted on March 18, 2025, in the New York Times. And what about that terrestrial welcoming committee? Pod of dolphins greets NASA astronauts. The marine mammals swarmed around the recovery team and capsule, welcoming home the astronauts shortly after they splashed down off Florida's Gulf Coast. By Sarah Ruberg, posted in the New York Times on March 18, 2025. SpaceX and the Coast Guard work together to try to keep civilian boaters away from returning spacecraft after astronauts splash down in the water. but on Tuesday night, they could not do anything about a pod of curious dolphins. A handful of the marine mammals swam up to a recovery boat that was set to lift the crew Dragon Freedom to its deck and surfaced from the clear blue waters. "Wow, we got a cute little pod of dolphins. It wasn't just one or two," said Kate Tice, an engineering manager at SpaceX who was commentating on the company's video stream. As the dolphin's dorsal fins bobbed, she said that the team working on retrieving the capsule was getting quick assists from the honorary part of the recovery team, those dolphins. Dolphins are generally social and playful marine mammals and often travel in groups or pods. The most common species near Florida's Gulf Coast are bottlenosed dolphins, according to the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission. Although it was not clear which species was circling the SpaceX crews on Tuesday. Todd Speakman, a field biologist with the National Marine Mammal Foundation, said while he couldn't definitively identify the dolphin species, he said it was likely a Stenella dolphin, which are often found near the Gulf Coast. He said he wasn't surprised that the pod approached the capsule shortly after splashdown. "With there being that much activity, they're just curious animals, so they're going to come check it out," Mr. Speakman said, adding that dolphins will often swim around their research ships. It's not the first time wildlife have visited astronauts just after they returned to Earth. In 2021, photographers captured a lone dolphin swimming near the recovery boats headed to pick up the Dragon spacecraft used for SpaceX Crew 1 mission. But an Orlando news station reported that the animal didn't stick around for the capsule's splashdown. Sarah Ruberg, who reported on this terrestrial welcoming party, covers breaking news and is a member of the 2024-2025 class of Times Fellows, a program for journalists early in their careers. Also from the New York Times, posted on March 18, 2025, and written by Claire Moses. Williams and Wilmore are not the first astronauts to be delayed in space. From a spacecraft's coolant leak to the disintegration of the Soviet Union, astronauts have gotten stuck in space for a variety of reasons over the decades of human spaceflight. The NASA astronauts Sonny Williams and Butch Wilmore are not the first to stay unexpectedly in space much longer than planned. Here are some other notable examples. On May 18, 1991, Sergei Krikalev set off into space for a stay at the Mir, the Soviet Union's space station at the time. While he was up there, the Soviet Union disbanded, and he was asked to extend his stay by almost 5 months, in part a result of the country's disintegration and money problems in Moscow. The episode turned him into a bit of a media celebrity, earning him the nickname "The Last Soviet Citizen." He stayed in space for 313 days, returning on March 25, 1992. In 2003, three astronauts, Ken Bowersox and Donald Pettit, both American, and Nikolai Buterin, a Russian, had to prolong their stay on the relatively new International Space Station by about 3 months. While they were in space, a NASA space shuttle disintegrated as it re-entered Earth's atmosphere and killed all seven astronauts on board in an incident that became known as the Columbia disaster. As a safety measure, NASA suspended its space shuttle flights. Eventually, after more than 5 months in space, the three astronauts landed back on Earth in a Russian capsule in May 2003. Dr. Pettit, now 69, returned to the space station aboard a Russian vehicle last fall for another stay and is scheduled to return to Earth in April of this year. In 2022, the American astronaut Frank Rubio headed to the International Space Station for a six-month stay. Instead, he stayed just over a year, 371 days, in what became the longest single space flight for a U.S. astronaut. In December 2022, after coolant leaked from the Russian spacecraft that was to be used to bring Mr. Rubio home, his return trip was delayed while a different spacecraft was sent to pick him up, and two Russian astronauts also. Like people serving in the military, you kind of grow up with the mindset of, you have to be ready for the unexpected, he said in an interview last August, because that's a very common thing. And Claire Moses, who reported on other examples on astronauts getting stuck in space for a longer time than planned, is a Times reporter in London, focused on coverage of breaking and trending news. And speaking of life in space, from the technically fiction section of the January 2025 issue of Science News, Where Are the Flying Cars? By Helen Bradshaw. The year is 2015. Mad scientist Doc Brown has just brought wide-eyed teenager Marty McFly to the future in style, aboard a flying DeLorean. Although the time travelers are out of place, their mode of transportation is not. Cars zip by in the sky. We are now 10 years past the future envisioned in Back to the Future Part 2, and still no flying cars. But aerial automobiles, a mainstay of sci-fi and fantasy stories since the early 1900s, may soon be reality. The technology to make flying cars already exists, says an aerospace engineer at Missouri University of Science and Technology in Roya. And some companies have already flown prototypes. A real-world flying car would most likely be a cross between an airplane and a helicopter. Airplanes need runways, so it would be more practical for a flying car to take off vertically like a helicopter. Rotating blades would generate lift to bring the vehicle off the ground. Once it's completed takeoff, you can fly like a normal airplane, says Professor Du, the aerospace engineer at Missouri University. Airplane wings would rotate out from the body, allowing for flight with less air resistance than a helicopter experience. Another option is to attach propellers to a flying car's wings. At first, the wings would be tilted upward so that the propellers could lift the vehicle. Once the car takes off, the wings would tilt to lay flat, like those on an airplane, says aerospace engineer Pat Anderson, former director of the Eagle Flight Research Center at Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University in Daytona Beach, Florida. It's like a transformer. Vehicles with rotating blades and propellers don't sound much like the flying cars of science fiction. They don't even sound much like cars. Instead, these vehicles would resemble winged military choppers, like those in the Avatar movies, Anderson says, or real-world winged choppers like the U.S. military's V-22 Osprey. One of the biggest barriers to people commuting in flying cars is expense. The U.S. company Aleph Aeronautics, for instance, plans to sell personal cars that can drive on roads and take off into the skies. These cars look and function similarly to those in many sci-fi movies, but come with a steep price tag. When they go into production sometime this year, the cars are expected to cost about $300,000 each. For people with more modest bank accounts, a rideshare service for flying cars, something like Uber or Lyft for the skies, may be more likely, Anderson says. Flying Ubers may become common in 10 or 20 years, he predicts. First, aircraft need to be tested over and over for safety. The U.S. Federal Aviation Administration also needs to create regulations for flying cars. In October, the FAA brought the industry closer to liftoff by announcing rules on operating and piloting air taxis. Those regulations pertain to a type of electric vehicle. Because of sustainability, people are kind of in love with batteries, Anderson says, but batteries are heavy and, like those in electric cars, have a limited range. Flying takes a lot of power, especially during takeoff. Current rechargeable lithium-ion batteries would power a flying car ride for only 20 to 30 minutes, Du says. And while a car that runs out of charge can simply pull over, a flying car would fall out of the sky. So Du and many other researchers are trying to improve battery efficiency before flying taxis take off. And where are the flying cars? Appears in the department Technically Fiction in the January 2025 issue of Science News. From Science News, October 19, 2024. From Notebook. First, Mexican free-tailed bat's toes glow in the dark. You've heard of jazz hands. Well, these bats have glow toes. In the dark, when ultraviolet light shines on the Mexican free-tailed bat's extraordinary hairy toes, they light up like a Christmas tree. That's because the animals have bristly structures that are capable of UV-induced photoluminescence, scientists reported on August 8th in the journal Mammalian Biology. The finding marks the first time that photoluminescent structures have been reported in live bats and places the Mexican free-tailed bat on an ever-growing list of creatures that can absorb UV light and re-emit it at a different wavelength. Biologist Fernando Wall Suarez says he will always remember the moment he heard a colleague utter, "Is that normal? Do the feet usually look like that?" It was January 2021, and his team had been catching Mexican free-tailed bats outside of a well-known roost in southern Mexico City. The night before, the researchers had caught bats further north and dusted them with a powder that shines under UV light. The hope was to later detect that powder on bats in the south, proving that the animals were moving between the locations. "We failed at that," says Juan Suarez of the National Autonomous University of Mexico in Mexico City. However, while searching for signs of the powder with their UV flashlights, the team stumbled upon something even cooler on the powderless bats: glow-in-the-dark toes. In visible light, a Mexican free-tailed bat looks like a fluff of dark fur. To be sure, the photoluminescent footsies weren't a result of powder residue or a local aberration. The researchers looked for and found similarly bright toes on 25 live bats at both sites, as well as on one bat captured more than 700 kilometers to the north. Scientists have found UV photoluminescence in platypuses, tardigrades, and other creatures. While many of these animals glow essentially from head to toe, in the bats, it's just the toes. What purpose the glowing toes serve is unclear. It's not yet known whether the bats can perceive the light wavelengths that appear as a brilliant scion to the human eye. As nocturnal creatures, Mexican free-tailed bats would encounter UV light mostly at dusk, dawn, and nights when the moon is unobstructed by clouds. Because the species migrates long distances and lives in colonies of millions of individuals, perhaps the glow toes aid communication, the team says. Mexican free-tailed bats, and there's a picture of it soaring with its wings fully outstretched, migrate thousands of kilometers and live in large colonies. Scientists suspect that the bats' light-up toes might serve a role in nighttime communication. This article posted by Jason Bittle. Next in the news, the Department of Plants. This flower launches missiles of pollen. The projectiles knock off competitors' pollen from bird beaks. For certain Brazilian red flowers, pollinators may act as sexual battlegrounds. Certain flowers use projectile blasts of pollen to knock off rival flowers' pollen from hummingbirds' beaks and replace it with their own, researchers reported in a study that is going to appear in the journal American Naturalist. The tactic may increase a male flower's chances of siring seeds in the next female flower the bird visits. H. macrantha flowers have both male and female reproductive organs. To avoid self-pollination, a flower goes through a male phase and then a female phase. hummingbirds transfer pollen between flowers. When visiting a male flower, a hummingbird's beak triggers a catapult-like mechanism that flings all of the flower's pollen in a single burst. Afterward, the flower becomes female. To see if projectile pollen blows away the competition, evolutionary ecologist Bruce Anderson of Stellenbosch University in South Africa and his colleagues simulated hummingbird visits by poking a hummingbird skull into flowers. First, the researchers applied pollen marked with tiny fluorescent particles to the part of the beak where pollen tends to accumulate. Next, the team inserted the bird's beak with its load of fluorescent pollen into a set of male and female flowers containing unmarked pollen and tracked where the marked and unmarked pollen particles ended up. The hummingbird beaks lost twice as much fluorescent pollen when inserted into an explosive flower versus an inert, already exploded flower. And the more fluorescent pollen an explosion removed, the more successful that explosion was at depositing the flower's own pollen onto the beak. High-speed video showed that pollen grains from exploding flowers functioned like missiles that knock existing pollen away. It's almost like there's a division of labor for pollen. Some of it is meant for mating, and some of it's meant for fighting, Anderson says. More research is needed, he adds, to determine whether the pollen blasts result in more offspring for H. macrantha. The animal world is full of males trying to get rid of rivals' sperm and replace it with their own. For example, many animal penises have elaborate structures for scooping sperm out of the female reproductive tract. Even the capped shape of the human penis may function to remove other men's sperm, research from evolutionary psychologist Rebecca Birch and her colleagues suggests. This is the first experimental evidence for a similar sperm cell removal strategy in plants. Plants are not just stationary objects, says Birch, of the State University of New York at Oswego. They engage in communication, competition, and now active reproductive sabotage of other plants. This article posted by Nala Rogers. And from the Department of Chemistry, hydrogen saps energy from batteries. Wrangling the atoms may be key to longer-lasting lithium-ion cells. Rechargeable lithium-ion batteries don't last forever. Over time, they hold on to less charge and eventually transform from power sources to bricks. A new study suggests one reason: leaky hydrogen. Unwanted hydrogen protons fill molecular slots in the positive end of the battery, leaving less room for charged lithium atoms or ions that maintain reactivity and help conduct charge, researchers reported in the September 13th issue of Science. The study identifies a set of undesirable chemical reactions that unfold when the battery's electrolyte, which is supposed to transport lithium atoms, had inadvertently released oxygen into the positive end, or cathode. This triggers all kinds of problems, reducing the capacity and lifespan of the battery, says materials physicist Gang Wan of Stanford University. Even if you're not using the battery, it loses energy. Explanations of energy loss in batteries typically focus on lithium ions. Some researchers have hypothesized that hydrogen atoms play a role, but it has been hard to observe because hydrogen is so small and ubiquitous. So Wan and colleagues swapped the hydrogen in the electrolyte of button-shaped batteries for deuterium, a heavier variant of hydrogen. The researchers then tracked the deuterium's movement with high-powered X-ray imaging and mass spectrometry. Combining the results with theoretical calculations showed that hydrogen is the key player in cathode charge loss. The study sheds light on the opaque chemistry unfolding inside batteries, says inorganic chemist Bart Bartlett of the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. That's significant because it hints at ways to adjust the chemistry to avoid hydrogen reactions. The work also highlights a problem in the push for increasingly high-voltage batteries, he says. Higher voltage cathodes are more reactive and thus more likely to pull in hydrogen. So the higher the battery voltage, the more hydrogenation takes place. It's a trade-off that I don't think we fully appreciated, Bartlett says. It's unclear whether the findings apply to other types of lithium-ion batteries. If so, the results could help speed up innovations like longer-range electric vehicles, says Jacqueline Edge, a batteries researcher at Imperial College London. Those new batteries might also decrease the need for mining battery minerals, which comes with negative environmental and social consequences. It would be a twofold sustainability win, she says. This series of articles appears in the October 19, 2024 issue of Science News. While some scientists are looking at ways to extend the lives of lithium-ion batteries, others are looking at a new option to replace them. From the Washington Post, Climate Solutions. Lithium-ion batteries have ruled for decades. Now they have a challenger. Sodium-ion batteries are emerging as a possible alternative. After decades of lithium-ion batteries dominating the market, a new option has emerged: batteries made with sodium ions. Scientists have been researching alternatives to lithium for years. Much of the world relies on this kind of battery, but the mining and processing of its materials can be harmful to workers, local communities, and the environment. Sodium has recently emerged as one of the more promising options, and experts say the material could be a cheaper and more environmentally friendly alternative to lithium. In the past few years, sodium-ion battery production has increased in the United States. Last month, sodium-ion battery manufacturer Natron Energy announced it would open a gigafactory in North Carolina that would produce 24 gigawatts of batteries annually, enough energy to charge 24,000 electric vehicles. But sodium-ion batteries are still early in their development compared with lithium-ion, and they have yet to hit the market on a massive scale. It's unlikely sodium-ion could displace lithium-ion anytime soon, said Keith Beers, polymer science and materials chemistry principal engineer at technical consultancy firm Exponent. Here's what to know about these batteries. How sodium-ion batteries work. There are many types of sodium-ion batteries, but the ones that will be manufactured in North Carolina are produced in the same way as lithium-ion batteries, just with different ingredients. Instead of using expensive materials like lithium, nickel, and cobalt, these will be made of sodium, iron, and manganese. In a battery, ions move between electrodes during a charging and discharging process to generate electricity, explains Alvaro Acosta, a senior director at the solar developer Lightsource BP. In a sodium-ion battery, sodium ions carry the charge, and the negative electrode is made up of common materials like iron, carbon, and nitrogen. Natron's batteries use iron and manganese for their negative electrodes. The biggest limitation of sodium-ion batteries is their weight. Sodium weighs nearly three times as much as lithium, and it cannot store the same amount of energy. As a result, sodium-ion batteries tend to be larger. Jens Peters, an economics professor at the University of Alcalá in Madrid, said the energy density could be improved over time in sodium-ion batteries. But he added, "What we found out so far in our assessments is that it is not a game changer." Are they more sustainable? Sodium-ion batteries are touted to be the environmentally friendly alternative to their lithium-ion counterparts, thanks to their raw materials. Sodium, iron, and manganese are all abundant elements on the planet, so they require less energy to extract and cost less. Everyone knows that lithium-ion batteries are the pulse of mobile phones, transportation, said Yang Kuk Soon, professor of energy engineering at Hanyang University in Seoul. The issue over lithium-ion batteries is that they use highly expensive materials like lithium, nickel, and cobalt. The environmental and human costs of that extractive mining are also issues, and at the end of their life, batteries made with these materials can leach toxins into the environment if disposed of improperly. Sodium-ion batteries also last longer than lithium-ion ones because they can withstand more charge cycles, said Wendell Brooks, co-CEO of Natron Energy. Our product can have millions of cycles, said Brooks, where lithium-ion would have 3,000 to 5,000 cycles and wear out a lot faster. But not all sodium-ion batteries are built alike, Beers said, or perform the same. And if a sodium-ion battery were to use the heavy metals found in lithium-ion batteries, then the environmental impact would likely be similar. Will they replace lithium? Experts say that sodium-ion batteries have limited uses compared with their lithium-ion counterparts, which currently power much of the technology in our lives, from smartphones to power tools to solar power backup storage. Their biggest selling point is their small size and energy density. They're small enough to fit in a camera, and a larger battery in your electric car can hold enough charge to drive a few hundred miles. Sodium-ion batteries aren't the best fit for smartphones or electric vehicles, which need to store lots of energy. However, one advantage is their low cost, and they could be a good candidate in situations where the size of the battery isn't a concern, like energy storage. When something is built out to support grid or backup storage, it doesn't need to be very dense. It's staying put, Beers said. And this article, written by Sarah Raza, was posted in the Washington Post on November 3, 2024. Under Climate Solutions, lithium-ion batteries have ruled for decades. Now they have a challenger. Sodium-ion batteries are emerging as a possible alternative. Next, a New York Times article poses the question, how many continents are there? You may not like the answers. Recent Earth science developments suggest that how we count our planet's largest land masses is less clear than we might have learned in school. Posted by Matt Kaplan on October 30, 2024. The world is split up into continents. There are seven in all. And if you get the gist, we are going to make a list, from biggest to small. Your kids may have come home from school singing this infectious ditty or another like it, but are there really seven continents? Anyone with a map can see that Asia and Europe are connected. They are often called Eurasia for that reason. The divide is pretty arbitrary, more culturally than scientifically defined. So is it fair to say that there are actually only six continents? That is just the first slippery step on a well-oiled slope. What about North America and Asia? They are connected by the Bering Sea Shelf, once dry land crossed by humans and flooded only in the geologically recent past. Technically speaking, that makes Asia, North America, and Europe all one continent. Does that mean there are only five? Other experts contend that 5, 6, and 7 are wrong and argue in favor of 8 continents. There are even those who go as far as to say there are only 2. Hiding within the simplicity of the song, there is an illusion of general agreement about the number of continents. The dispute arises in part because there are really 2 types of continents, those recognized by cultures around the world, and those recognized by geologists. Cultures can define a continent any way they want, while geologists have to use a definition. And geological research in recent years has made defining continental boundaries less simple than it might have once seemed, as researchers find evidence of unexpected continental material. This triggers a lot of interest because there are significant implications for our understanding of the mechanisms of continent separation, ocean formation, and plate tectonics, said Valentin Rehm, a geologist at the University of Freiburg in Switzerland. He added, "But after the excitement comes rigorous checking and debate to make sure the evidence is solid." Geologically speaking, to be a continent, a bit of the planet needs to have four things: a high elevation relative to the ocean floor, a wide range of igneous, metamorphic, and sedimentary rocks rich in silica, a crust thicker than the surrounding oceanic crust, and well-defined limits around a large enough area. The first three requirements are found in just about every geology textbook, but not so with the fourth. What is large enough, or how well-defined the limits of a potential continent need to be, are matters that are less often discussed, unless a geologist is studying bits of the planet that are on the cusp of being continental. "Anything big enough to change the map of the world is important," said Nick Mortimer, a geologist with the New Zealand government-owned GNS Science Research Institute. "Labeling and identifying part of the Earth as a continent, even a small, thin, and submerged one, is more informative than just leaving a map blank." This creates problems for numbering continents. Consider Iceland, which sits atop a rift that stretches around Earth, the Atlantic branch of the mid-oceanic ridge. Volcanic activity there slowly separates the tectonic plates on which North America and Europe rest. Most of the ridge lies deep beneath the ocean, but in Iceland, it sits above sea level. Another enigma is that the volcanoes there often spit out lava made of molten continental crust, even though Iceland is thousands of miles from any other continents. Some geologists, therefore, suspect Iceland is not a lonely island at sea, but actually part of a continent. Although, as to which one, that can get complicated, too. That notion finds support off Africa's eastern coast. A mid-oceanic ridge in the Red Sea is dividing Africa from Asia. This divorce is happening at the rate at which fingernails grow. Along most of the ridge, the separation is straightforward, but the separation is much messier where the Red Sea meets the Gulf of Aden. In place of an obvious point of thinning where ocean crust is forming, the continental crust between Africa and Asia is splintering into hundreds of pieces. In that location, there is no obvious point where Africa ends and Asia begins. It is like very strong and very thick toffee getting stretched out, but not snapping, said Gillian Folger, a geologist at Durham University in England. Dr. Rehm and colleagues recently published a study in the journal Geology showing that Iceland, too, has heavily stretched toffee beneath its surrounding seas. Instead of a clean break between North America and Europe, there appears to be a complex mix of magma and continental crust fragments scattered in a path between the two land masses that runs right through Iceland. Just like the point where the Red Sea and the Gulf of Aden meet, there is no clear point where North America ends and Europe begins. Of course, if Africa is still attached to Asia through the Gulf of Aden and North America is still attached to Europe, this kind of messes up the Seven Continents song. If the crust between these continents is stretching but not snapping, is it well-defined enough to identify the two land masses as separate continents? Or are they still one? Then there is New Zealand, which really wrecks things for our kids. Although New Zealand and Australia are often grouped together, they are not on the same continent. While Australia is widely considered to be a continent in its own right, the notion that New Zealand is part of its own continent, Zealandia, is a newer argument. Submerged shelves that rise high above the ocean floor stretch for miles far beyond the tiny island nation. Along the edges of those shelves, there is deep water and oceanic crust that is thinner than the crust beneath the shelves. Drill cores, seabed dredge samples, and rocks collected from the region show that the giant mass that New Zealand sits on is composed of igneous, metamorphic, and sedimentary rocks rich in silica, just as is the case with all other continents. While few think of Zealandia as a continent in cultural terms, it is increasingly being recognized as a geological one, Dr. Mortimer said. But not everyone agrees, and they point to that meddlesome fourth criterion ignored in most textbooks. The crust making up Zealandia is between 10 and 30 kilometers thick, making it thicker than the 7 kilometers of most ocean crust. But it is not as thick as other continents' crust, typically between 30 and 46 kilometers. This makes the boundaries between Zealandia and the ocean less well-defined and more difficult to discern. Size creates issues, too. At 4.9 million square kilometers, the proffered Zealandia is much smaller than Australia, which itself is only 7.7 million square kilometers. Then there is the fact that Zealandia is mostly submerged. Being above water is not part of the geological definition of a continent, but it does seem to matter culturally because people are used to thinking of continents as dry land. Geologists are still arguing what these discoveries about continental and oceanic crust mean for the number of continents. What is certain is that the research is revealing that there is more than one way for two continents to split apart, and that the split is not always clean or even complete. There are basically only two major continents, Dr. Ream said, Antarctica and everything else, since South America is connected to North America through Panama. North America is connected to Asia through the Bering Strait, and Asia is connected to Europe, Africa, and Australia through the Urals, the Sinai, and Indonesia, respectively. Dr. Mortimer doesn't agree. Zealandia is separated from Australia by a 25-kilometer-wide, 3,600-meter-deep ocean trough, he said. Based on Valentin's logic, that would mean there are actually three continents. But he acknowledged some uncertainty, adding, unless the trough is found to be very deep continental crust, like the Iceland situation, in which case Zealandia would be a part of Australia. And then there is the possibility that Iceland is sitting on top of its own large chunk of free-floating crust, as perhaps continent number 9. If true, Icelandia would join a growing fellowship of continents large and small, Dr. Folger said. Culturally, this research and the arguments it provokes change nothing, which is a good thing, because if there were only two continents, there might not be an infectious tune for your children to sing. And this very involved argument about how many continents are there was posted on October 30th, 2024, in the New York Times. And finally, a book review from the December 2024 issue of Scientific American. End of the World and Hard-Boiled Wonderland, a new translation, written by Haruki Murakami and translated by Jay Rubin, published by Everyman's Library in 2024. First translated from the Japanese in 1991 by Alfred Birnbaum, Haruki Murakami's award-winning 1985 novel is a tale of two worlds. One is a clever pastiche of cyberpunk and detective tropes, where rival syndicates secretly vie for dominance. The other is a surreal fantasy where old dreams are read from the skulls of mysterious one-horned creatures. In a new translation, longtime Murakami translator Jay Rubin restores, at the author's request, roughly 100 pages of previously excised material. This new material noticeably lengthens the novel, but doesn't significantly increase its pleasures, pleasures one reaches only by wading through too much juvenile erotica and misogyny, including a novel-length depiction of a 17-year-old character termed the Fat Girl, whose body composition and sexual possibility are central preoccupations. Still, Murakami fans will enjoy the chance to read the novel in a form closer to the author's original intent and make comparisons between the familiar Birnbaum and Rubin's newer effort. Rubin nonetheless keeps many of Birnbaum's choices intact, including the names of the secretive Calcatecs and their criminal rivals, the Semiotics. Rubin has chosen to revert the title's order in English to that of the original Japanese, giving primacy to the better of Murakami's settings, the mysterious walled town called End of the World. Here, the translator's decisions matter considerably, with Rubin choosing heart instead of Birnbaum's mind for the apparently difficult-to-translate kokoro, which Rubin explains actually straddles the full territory of mind, heart, and morality. Although the relative limitations of English occasionally risk reduced complexity, the resulting language often still moves, as when one narrator pledges his emergent dream reading skills to help his romantic interest recover her lost heart, her missing kokoro. "The heart is not like raindrops," he promises. "It doesn't fall from the sky, indistinguishable from other things. I'll find it for sure. Anything and everything is here, and anything and everything is not here." As it is when Murakami's two storylines finally come together, it's where mind, heart, and morality converge that end of the world and hard-boiled wonderland is at its best. This review, written by Matt Bell, and appears in the December 2024 issue of Scientific American. And that brings us to the end of today's broadcast of Science Matters. My name is Cynthia Ellick, and I've been your host today on Sun Sounds of Arizona. And remember, if you missed any part of this program, you can access it on demand at sunsounds.org and click Broadcast Info and Audio. Thank you so much for listening, and please join me again next week.